This is continuing coverage.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now back to the courtroom.
Was there self-defense?
Was there justifiable self-defense?
And the self-defense instruction is long, and you'll have it to review in the back. However, what you will notice are two words that come up all the time in that instruction. Self-defense, justifiable use of deadly force, would be Ashley Benefield was justified in using deadly force if she reasonably believed such force was necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm or a forcible felony. You're going to see those two words. And like I told you a little bit earlier, that's what you need to think of each time that you're trying to evaluate whether she used force appropriately. So let's get to the date of the offense, okay? Clearly, these two are getting along, at least according to Doug Benefield. He thought they were getting along. If you look at the text messages between the two of them, if you go by the information that you had from the witness stand that Ashley was acting nice, she was acting like they were going to try and reconcile in Maryland. They were moving together. They were using the same truck. He was coming to her house to help her move the heavy things. So they were getting along. They actually went to the mediation during this time. It was about 3 days before she killed him. They had mediation where they said they were going to drop everything, move into Maryland, everything's going to be fine. But obviously that was not Ashley Benefield, because she knew she wasn't going to drop the injunction. Obviously, the day of the offense, Doug Benefield had a right to be at the house. She invited him over. They had text messages back and forth. Trucker on the way, you know, he's taking a picture of the stuff in the back of his truck. And she'd let him in the gate numerous times before. So he had a right to be at the house. She clearly was not afraid, but she had him over. And then her mother clearly was not afraid for her, because then as soon as he gets there, she goes to the park with the daughter. So nobody's afraid at this point for Ashley Benefield's safety. And there's only one person who knows what happened in that house that is still alive, and that's Ashley Benefield. And you heard her story, and she made herself a witness just like any other witness in this trial. And you will judge her credibility and the truth of what she said just like you do any other witness, and see if it matches the evidence in this case. If you noticed, when being asked questions, she became evasive. If questions got a little too difficult, or she didn't really have an answer for it, specifically on cross-examination, she would use methods to avoid answering the question. One of the methods that you saw over and over was, I don't know. The other method was crying, started crying. Did you ever see one tear come out of her eye? Did you ever see one drop of liquid, one red eye, one swollen eye? She had a breakdown. We had to take a break. Crying hysterically. Takes the stand right after that. Eyes are just fine. Makeup's just fine. That goes to her credibility. What is she trying to convey to you? The truth or her version of event? Let's look at what she did say. She said during this move that Doug bumps her on the shoulder a couple times, body check or something. She didn't really act that out very well. Who knows what that was. Doug, carrying a box, rammed a box into her stomach and scratched her. But did you see those pictures? Does that scratch look like a scratch from a cardboard box? Wouldn't you expect a bruise to be there as well? You'll have the pictures in the back. So look at those pictures and see. There's no bruising. They look like cat scratches. The defendant also said when they were by the front door to the house, that he grabbed her by the wrist and hit her in the head. So when I ask, hey, what do you mean hit? Well, I don't know. Okay, was it an open hand? Was it a closed hand? What was it? I don't know. She should know if a grown man balled up his fist and punched her in the side of the head. And there would be a lot more damage than what she claimed she had. But she didn't know. He just hit her. Now, four people testified that they saw her after this incident. Very shortly after this incident. Well, one of them was 3 days later. But the rest of them were very shortly after this incident. John Sands, the neighbor, he didn't see any swelling. He didn't see any injury. He didn't see any disheveled clothes like there'd been a, you know, rumble. Deputy Burrell, was the one that put her in the back of his squad car. No injury. Didn't notice any injuries to her head or swelling to her face. Crime scene tech Dvorak took pictures. Didn't notice any injuries, any swelling to the face. 3 days later, crime scene tech Conlin takes pictures just to make sure, because bruises don't always come up right away, that she's not bruised. No bruises, no swelling, no nothing. But yet the defendant sits right here and tries to tell you that her eye was droopy and the side over here was swollen.
Let's look at these pictures.
These are four pictures that were entered into evidence. The first picture was, the defendant said, was before she even knew Doug Benfield. She thought before she knew him. The second picture over to, at the top, over on the right, is the night of the shooting. Down lower left is 3 days later. And then one over is about six weeks later. Does it really look like her face is swollen? She said the side, she said right here, on the right side. Or I'm sorry, the left side.
Right here.
The left side of her face doesn't, it actually looks slimmer than it did in the picture taken before she even knew Doug. So let's talk about what she did when she claims that Doug grabbed, I think she said she was going for the front door, he grabbed her arm, she kind of spun around, he hits her in the head, although she didn't know if it was overhand or not, and then she said, I just wanted to get away. I just wanted to get away, right? Here's the front door, right? She went this way and could have gone right out the door if she just wanted to get away. She didn't go right out the door. She turned to her right and went into this room. This room that has nothing in it except for a mattress, a broom, and a hamper, and two handguns. It's hard to see in this picture because of the lighting, but I just want to remind everyone, here's the mattress, here's the broom, nothing else in this room, but there's a hamper right here with a gun on it, and there's a gun in this closet right here, and that's where she runs. And this is a better picture of the hamper and where the murder weapon was. So she just wants to get away, but she runs into the very back corner of this room and grabs a firearm. Now, she claims that as she's retrieving this firearm, he slams the door open, she turns around, right? And she sees him standing there. When I asked her to get down and show me what he was doing. That was another one of those debates. I don't know. He was in a fighter stance. I don't know what fighters do, but I know it's a fighter stance. Okay, well, show me. What do you mean a fighter stance? I don't know, kind of like this. Okay, well, what are his hands doing? Just kind of moving around. Okay, so his hands are kind of moving around and it didn't look a lot like a fighter stance. And then she said, I'm standing there with the gun pointed at him and he lunges at me. He lunges at me. Let's think about this. So if she's standing in the room, she has the gun in her hand, and he just came in the door, and she's pointing the gun at him. She says he takes a fighting stance. First of all, he's right-handed. Do this yourselves when you get in the back. If someone told you to get in a fighting stance, what would you do? And determine for yourself. Use your common sense. Which side would be bladed away? I think you'll find that your strong hand is going to be the one that's bladed away. So if he's right-handed, he's in a fighting stance, he's going to be like this. Interesting, because he's shot from this side. So he's like this, and then she says he lunges at her, right? So if he lunges at her, he's head on, straight on to her, lunging. That bullet hole would have been here and out here. Would have gone straight through him, front to back. That is not the way that bullet went side to side. And if he's in a fighting stance and he's right-handed, why would he have this side towards her? And Mr. Haig, the expert, the firearms expert, displayed when I said, okay, I'm going to point a gun at you. You show me where your body would have to be in order to get that trajectory. And he turned sideways. So his body in his fighting stance would have to be completely sideways. And what, he's skipping to her to lunge? I mean, how is that trajectory going to happen based on what she said? More than likely, the hands that were up was a defensive. He probably came into the room and said, whoa, she's got a gun. Started to turn around. He had his hands up, like, whoa, what are you doing? Makes no sense to be in a fighting stance. So I want to talk a little bit about this trajectory just because there's sort of some misconception that this shot was front to back. That is just the planes with which the medical examiner uses. So it can be a little confusing. But if you look at the way this arrow is, the bullet goes in right by the right nipple and then lands right here. So it is side to side. Now, once it went in where the nipple is, did it curve a little bit to the back? Yes, that's why it's like in the back. That's why they say front. So it went side to side and a little bit to the back. There is no way he was facing her when she shot him. No way. Here's another angle. This is from the back. So if it went in on the side, the right-hand side, and that red dot is where it landed in the back. And let's talk about the leg wound. It's very hard to determine exactly how this leg wound happened. And we may never know exactly how it happened. But this is the basic trajectory of it. If a person were in a normal anatomic, standard anatomic position, this is both the medical examiners said that. This is a standard anatomical position. So in a standard anatomical position, that is the way the wound path went through his leg. So you can figure out for yourself different ways that that might have happened. Now, Dr. Liu said, based on information that she got from Ashley Benefield, by the way, that it must have happened this way. That once he shot the first time, somehow he falls and his legs go way up in the air and he shot like this. Where did that bolt go if he was shot like that? The expert testified about the two that went into the wall had not gone through a body. He said the one that hit the leg was in the room. Might have been kicked, and that's normal when you have emergency technicians in there and they're kicking things around. But the projectile was in the room. It was not in the wall. So if he's falling back this way and his legs flipping way up, and by the way, Dr. Vega said the only way your legs flip up like that is if you're falling over a rail or, you know, falling over something and your legs come up that high. So that just does not make sense with the rest of the evidence. Now, this may not be the way it happened, but it is also another way that it could have happened. He is turned away, leg up, and that bullet could have gone in and come out his knee, but his leg is bent. So you use your own judgment and decide what you think about that leg wound. What's important is this one. This was the wound that killed him, and he was not facing her at the time. The defendant trying to say he was in a fighting stance, he lunged at me. That is just her, once again, trying to manipulate the system. She's trying to manipulate you to believe that this was necessary, he was coming at me. But the physical evidence does not bear that out. It does not show that he was coming at her and that she had to shoot. And afterwards, she runs over to the neighbor's house. Not once do you hear her say, get an ambulance, I don't know if he's still alive. You know, I had to do it, but somebody help him. Not once did you ever hear any concern that I just shot another human being, regardless of what the facts are. No. And then she sees her mother come by the car. Not once does she say, Mom, he just came at me. Like, I had to shoot him. It was awful. Nope, not a word. She goes back to her mom that night. Not a word. Really? You're not going to tell your mom exactly what happened? And then this lady, Russell, Barbara Russell, that she lives with for 9 months after the shooting, never tells her what happened. Not once. Remember, the defendant sat right there and said the defendant never punched her, ever. Never choked her, never kicked her, never came at her with a knife, never came at her with a club, never came at her with a bat. And she was the only person armed in that room. Doug Benefield was not armed. He had no weapon. He was laying on the floor dying, and she goes to the neighbor and not once asks for an ambulance. And he dies, either on the way to the hospital or in the hospital. She was the only one armed, and it was not necessary. She did not have to shoot him. It was not reasonable. She did not have to shoot him. She had an agenda, and it worked for what she wanted, and she got what she wanted. Because after she killed him, what did she get? Sole custody of the child. And that's murder. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Taylor, do you need the screen?
No.
We'll turn that off for you. Yes, sir, when you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I have a bit of a cold. I tested 3 times and it's not COVID. Don't need to be concerned. I've just listened to the state's closing argument. I have to tell you, I think there's obviously some real different perceptions of what the evidence is. I think perhaps there's even been some distortions. You all have taken, we've observed, pretty careful notes. If I say something that is not reflected in your notes or is not as you recall it, I want you to trust your own recollection. But I think if you check your notes, you will find that what I represent to you is accurate. This is and has been a fundamentally flawed prosecution. And I think we can demonstrate that through the testimony of two of the state's witnesses. The first is Stephanie Murphy. And you may recall she was the attorney who was representing Douglas Benefield. In my cross-examination of Stephanie Murphy, I served up for all of us, but especially for you, the members of the jury, what the state's theory of prosecution was. And I said, so Miss Murphy, let's be clear so that there's no misunderstandings. It's your belief and the state's theory that Ashley Benefield killed her husband because the Broder report was scheduled to be released 3 days later. She said, that's correct. Check your notes. Now, the state, in their opening statement, even made it dramatic. They said to you, this report by Dr. Broder was to be released on the 30th of September, but she killed him on the 27th to avoid that. If you look at the emails that had been introduced into evidence that reflect the conversations back and forth between Stephanie Murphy, Faith Brown, Miss Benefield's family court attorney at the time, and the judicial assistant for Judge Moreland, you will read in no uncertain terms, black and white, the Broder report was not set to be released on September 30th. Not only was it not set to be released on September 30th, there was not even a day for it to be released scheduled. Stephanie Murphy was attempting to have it scheduled. The J.A. wrote back in no uncertain terms, Judge Moreland will not hear that. The only thing being heard on September 30th is the domestic violence injunction. The other witness that I think reflects what a fundamentally flawed prosecution this is Detective Gillum. Now, you might recall that Detective Gillum, check your notes, said that the South Carolina domestic violence injunction that required no contact by either one did not go into effect until November 27th. But if you look at the written email that we introduced into evidence, where Detective Gillum is contacting Gina Torsha, Miss Murphy's assistant, Detective Gillum tells her, wait a second, he's helping them. Wait a second, this injunction, unless I'm reading this wrong, this injunction went into effect on November 3rd. The judge signed the order on November 27th, but on November 3rd, he announced it in open court, and Doug was present, and so was Ashley. So unless I'm reading this wrong, I want you to be aware of that. This is Gillum trying to help them. This is the same Gillum who gives you quotes of exactly what Ashley Benefield said 2.5 years later without having one word of it written in his earlier report. The same Gillum who I asked the following questions of. Detective Gillum, do they teach you in police academy about the importance of writing reports? Sure. And is the reason why the reports are so important is because it preserves important facts about a particular incident? Yes. So how many cases do you handle, Detective Gillum, in a month? You might recall he said, well, probably about 20. And then we multiplied that out by 2.5 years. I think we were into about 600, 700 cases. Yet he remembers the exact word she had to say, despite the fact that on the day she said it, not one word of it appears in his supplement 2.5 years earlier. Ladies and gentlemen, Detective Gillum, you might also recall, countermanded the capias, the arrest warrant that the other deputy issued for Doug Benefield when Ashley went down there and explained that Doug Benefield had mailed her this package in violation of the South Carolina restraining order. Detective Gillum said he remanded it, he reversed it, and he was going to refer it over to the state attorney's office. This was a good old boy network. They liked Doug, and they never looked back. And that's the truth of the matter. Do you not find it astounding that Detective Gillum, 2.5 years later, could remember such things as Ashley Benefield saying, if the judge sees you arrest him in front of her, it'll help me keep my baby? Isn't that something that you would put in a report? I think perhaps the most disturbing thing about the testimony of Stephanie Murphy and Detective Gillum is the following. Remember that common sense I told you about that you're going to be able to take with you back into the jury room and that without offending anybody, there would probably be more than 100 years worth of it, which there is? Does anyone believe that either side calls witnesses that they don't know what they're going to say? So how do you reconcile the state calling Murphy and Gillum knowing that they're going to testify inaccurately? Read Gillum's written email about how he misrepresented his knowledge of when that South Carolina domestic violence injunction went into effect when he testified in front of you, and read the emails between Stephanie Murphy, Faith Brown, and Judge Moreland's judicial assistant. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happens after that testimony? I want you to remember that the state's theory of prosecution up to that point is that Ashley Benefield... Is that Ashley Benefield killed Douglas Benefield to stop the release of the Broder report because she was so afraid of what was in it. And right in front of your eyes, I've never seen it before, right in front of your eyes, the state changes their theory, and the next thing you know, their theory of prosecution is she killed him because the domestic violence injunction was scheduled 3 days later. Check your notes. See if what I'm telling you is not accurate. Both theories, honestly, are ridiculous.
Objections. Sustained on that.
Both theories are not supported by common sense. Let's look at Broder. What exactly was it in Broder's report that Ashley Benefield was so afraid of that she killed Douglas Benefield? Check your notes, but try to think back to Broder's testimony. I think your notes will reveal that Broder never had one thing adverse to say about Ashley Benefield. In fact, the only thing that Broder had to say was that after evaluating Ashley Benefield, he found that she had no violent tendencies. She was not prone to impetuous acts. That's it. Her only concern, according to Dr. Kintel, was that she was afraid if Doug found out what she had to say about him, that he would take it out on her or on the child. Okay, let's look at the theory then when it shifts to it being the domestic violence injunction that was scheduled for the 30th of September. What kind of reason exactly is that for her to kill Doug Benefield? If that was a reason, wouldn't she have done it before? There was already a domestic violence injunction the first time. It was denied. It was not only denied, but Judge Moreland ordered shared custody of the child. Why wouldn't she have killed him then? For 4 years, Ashley Benefield did what any law-abiding citizen can be expected to do. She filed complaint after complaint after complaint, calling Doug Benefield's behavior to the attention of the authorities with no result. Over and over again. No relief. So she kills him? Really, that's quite a leap, ladies and gentlemen. You need evidence to support such an inference. You know, you can't take innuendo and wrap it up in an inference and call it a fact. You gotta have evidence that supports a theory. For example, you know, in the reasonable doubt instruction, I'm going to show you in a minute, but it says a reasonable doubt can arise from the evidence, from the lack of evidence, and from a conflict in the evidence. So what evidence would you need to show to support this theory that flies in the face of common sense? Well, how about somebody who comes in and testifies, yes, I heard Ashley, I overheard her say, you know what, I killed this SOB before I'd let him be alone with my child. Or how about this? How about downloading from Ashley's phone when she's sitting there in her most private moments, never expecting it to be revealed to the world, searching on the internet how to kill an abusive spouse? How about that? Instead, what you saw in her most private moments 6 months before this happened was her searching on the internet how to co-parent with an abusive spouse. Am I making this up? Check your notes. How to get along with an abusive spouse. In my opening statement, I told you two things. I said that at the conclusion of the case, those were the only two things that would be established beyond the reasonable doubt. The first one was that Doug Benefield was a very sick guy. I think there's no doubt of that. The second thing was that Ashley's action on that day, September 27th, 2020, was absolutely justified. Let's take a look briefly at Douglas Benefield's behavior. And I want you to keep in mind Bruce Ferris's testimony, who's the former cop who specialized in domestic violence, ran a domestic violence department, and then was so fascinated by it, went back to school to become a licensed mental health counselor. I thought he was a pretty persuasive witness. Doug Benefield shoots a gun into the ceiling of their kitchen to intimidate Ashley to stop speaking. Now, those are easy words for me to speak, and they fall on ears and you move on to the next thing. But I want you to try to imagine how it would feel.
Sustained.
How would one feel sitting in their kitchen, having their husband pull out a gun and actually fire it into the ceiling of their kitchen? Can you imagine the trauma of such a statement? Do you think that that's something that you forget about after 6 months, after a year? I think that's something you remember for the rest of your life. You never forget it. Throwing a loaded gun at Ashley Benefield, threatening suicide, not only to Ashley, but to his former wife, Renee. You've got a copy of her text message that she wrote to Doug, kicking her on their honeymoon and threatening suicide. So this is twice now, not only with Ashley, but with his prior wife, punching the dog so hard that he knocked the dog unconscious. Bruce Ferris on the wheel. Now, I'm not an expert on the wheel. I don't pretend to know it anywhere near as well as apparently Miss O'Donnell does. But I can tell you with certainty that it has a provision, and Bruce Ferris elaborated on the fact that abusers tend to hurt pets because they have no empathy and because, check your notes, they can control the victim because the victim loves the pets. So hurt the pets, you keep the victim in line. You get compliance, control and compliance. That's what they seek. Threw the cat down the stairs, put a tracker on her car. The neighbor catches him in the yard at night. It wasn't in the house across the street. You've got the schematic of the houses in the neighborhood. You see Mr. Sands' house is right next door, literally to the left of Ashley's house. Ashley's house has got the red dot on it. Cursing, yelling, screaming, belittling, text messages. I'm in a murderous mood. I want to rid the earth of them. Take them out. That was about two guys having a conversation while Ashley was on a cruise. Doug Benefield was so demented that just hearing in the background two men speaking while Ashley was on a cruise makes him say he wants to take them out, rid the earth of them. That puts him in a murderous mood. Of course, Ashley at the time at 24 thinks, well, gee, that's kind of flattering. I guess this guy really loves me. Oh, that was just a little tip of the hat to what was to come. The South Carolina injunction. He violated it. There's no way around that. How about driving from South Carolina to Florida so that you could follow Ashley in the car? I mean, if that's not determination, what is? If that's not fixation, what is? If that's not obsession, what is? And most chilling, I thought, was Mr. Vince Accaro, the realtor, who, while the injunction is in effect from South Carolina, look at the email between Doug Benefield and Vince Visicaro. I asked him, did you have any dealings with Douglas Benefield? Yes, I did. What was it? He was a customer looking to buy a home. Where was that home? It was the house immediately behind Ashley Benefield's house. This is sick, ladies and gentlemen. This is while the domestic violence injunction is in effect. Not only that, but then he says to Mr. Visicaro, well, I have to first check with Ashley. Well, you know that. That's a lie. He can't check with Ashley because the injunction doesn't allow him to communicate with Ashley. So what's the basis for that conclusion that Doug was that disturbed? Well, how about Doug's own admissions? You have the text messages where he admits to Ashley, you know, I'm sorry, I apologize. And according to Miss O'Donnell, well, that should be the end of it. You apologized, it's over. Unfortunately, Bruce Ferris explained to you that that's the MO of an abuser. Oh, baby, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. It'll never happen again. And it happens again, time and time and time again. That's their pattern of behavior. And Bruce Ferris told you that. He explained that to you. Ashley Benefield got on the stand and told you about all of that. And I have a great discrepancy. I'm wondering if we were at the same trial between Miss O'Donnell's evaluation of Ashley's testimony and ours. But how about this? In addition, as a basis to establish how disturbed Doug was, how about the letter that Ashley Benefield leaves for Doug in on November 17th?
Sustained.
Judge, I was testified to by Miss Benefield. I'm just speaking to the letter, not quoting from the letter itself.
Okay.
So she told you that she left him a letter. She told you what she put in that letter. That letter recounted some of the things that he did, some of the things that you heard about in the trial, such as shooting the gun, punching the dog. So, how about that as a basis to support it? She described them as controlling and manipulative. You're putting me and my unborn child in danger by the way you drive. You drive crazy when you get angry. How about Dr. Kinnell? He doesn't even have a dog in this fight. He's got absolutely no reason to shade his testimony one way or the other. What did he tell you that he concluded about Doug? That he was, quote, super controlling, unquote. That he was jealous. That he was intimidating. That he was a real alpha male. Dr. Kinnell's description, not mine, ladies and gentlemen. And then we have Ashley, who's the victim of domestic violence. We have the history of the prior acts of domestic violence by Doug. According to Dr. Broder, the state's witness, and Bruce Ferris, our witness, victims of domestic violence look for appeasement. Dr. Broder, I even asked him, I think that word appeasement appears in your report about at least four times. They go along to get along. They walk on eggshells, always afraid that something they might say will set them off. And according to Bruce Ferris, what the abuser wants is compliance. That dynamic changes very significantly once a child is introduced into it. And why is that? Because the abused woman is going to look to protect her child. That's what mommies do. So she will put herself in danger in order to stand between the abuser and her child. Yet, Ms. O'Donnell argues, well, when they first exchanged custody, as Stephanie Murphy said, Ashley looked happy and very content. Well, we know from Bruce Ferris that that's the compliance mode. That's what you do to protect your child. She knew how Doug was. He went off on her. The only thing worse than that would be him going off on Emerson, the child. You keep the beast at bay. Those were the words of Broder and of Bruce Ferris. Importantly, Bruce Ferris told you that victims of domestic violence appear to act happy. So you have these text messages in the week leading up to the shooting where they're saying nice things to one another with emojis and smiley faces. And you have the video of the restaurant where Ashley and her mother and Emerson are present. And Ashley appears to be acting happy when in fact she's actually quite scared, according to Bruce Ferris. But you go along to get along. You might recall in the voir dire, I asked you about the presumption of innocence and how many of you had ever seen a cop car on the side of the road with somebody sitting in the back. And the first thing you thought to yourself was, gee, I wonder what they did to cause them to be in the back of the squad car. And I told you that the issue to be resolved in this case was going to be, was the force used justified? All of you pledged that if the state failed to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, your verdict would be not guilty. All of you took an oath that said, at the end of the case, if you were unsure, if you did not know what happened, if you did not have an abiding conviction of guilt, you'd vote not guilty. I want to show you the beyond a reasonable doubt instruction. Deputy, if I could have the easel, please. This is in your packet of instructions. You're not going to have to memorize it. I want to just go over it, though, for a moment. I think we can agree it's pretty important. It reminds you that the state has the obligation and the burden to prove the case and overcome the evidence to the exclusion of and beyond a reasonable doubt. And here's how they define reasonable doubt. A reasonable doubt is not a mere possible doubt, a speculative, imaginary, or forced doubt. Such a doubt must not influence you to return a verdict of not guilty if you have an abiding conviction of guilt. On the other hand, if after carefully considering, comparing, and weighing all the evidence, there is not an abiding conviction of guilt, or if having a conviction, it is one which is not stable, but one which wavers and vacillates, goes back and forth, gee, I don't know, I'm not sure, then the charge is not proved beyond every reasonable doubt, and you must, not you can, ladies and gentlemen, not you may, you must find the defendant not guilty because the doubt is reasonable. A reasonable doubt as to guilt of the defendant may arise from the evidence, conflict in the evidence, or the lack of evidence. Thank you, Deputy. Take a brief look at the facts rather than theories, because once again the prosecution could not have been more clear. Ashley killed Doug to prevent release of the Broder report. So where was the evidence to support that theory? You can't simply say it and make it so. Miss O'Donnell comes up, and the evidence that she presents to you to support that theory is that Ashley said, I'll take matters into my own hands. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Broder testified that Ashley made that statement on her way out of his waiting room, and I asked him specifically about it. Please check your notes. What was she referring to? And he said, going to the authorities in Maryland to seek relief from them because the system here had failed her, and she was very frustrated. Ms. O'Donnell also told you that Doug Benefield filed for sole custody of Ashley. Please check your notes. No one ever testified to that. There's absolutely no evidence in this case that such a thing was done or a statement was made. Other evidence in the case? Justin Warren, the lead homicide detective. State never even called him. We called him. What did he tell you? He told you that in his arrest warrant, he said it did not appear that Douglas Benefield was facing Ashley Benefield when shot. Now look, Dr. Vega came in here and testified that the shooting in the chest, the shot to the chest, was from front to back. Yet Miss O'Donnell comes up here and distorts that and tries to tell you that it wasn't from front to back. It was from side to side. Dr. Vega told you the trajectory of the chest shot was front to back, right to left. Now, not only did Dr. Vega tell you that, Michael Hay told you that, front to back. Dr. Liu told you that, front to back. There has never been any evidence introduced in this trial that the chest shot or the arm was anything other than front to back. Detective Warren told you he did not speak with the medical examiner before he submitted his arrest warrant. I showed him his report to refresh his recollection. Oh, yes, I did speak to the medical examiner. And finally, I asked Detective Warren about a supplemental report that he wrote where there's a section that provides for any bias that he was aware of that Ashley would have had against Doug. And the form was written none. And I asked, is that not where you would write in things like ill will, hate, or spite? Mike Haig, let's look at his testimony for a minute. I think you'll remember him. What he said, I thought, really presented it well, was in explaining what forensic meant. He said it's the juncture where law meets physical science. Okay? So he told you there were four shots. He gave you a 3-dimensional diagram, and it showed you the room and how the shooting took place and where the shots went. One shot, according to Michael Haig, went out the door and down the hallway and lodged in a book. He described it as a miss. One shot was in the wall. Told you it was a nice round hole in the wall. They put a trajectory rod in it. One shot was in Mr. Benefield's chest. It was lodged in his back. Dr. Vega removed it. And one shot was in the leg. The state's own witness, crime scene people, told you that the shot to the leg was on the floor in the room and that a piece of it had broken off. And Haig told you that as well. According to Ms. O'Donnell, if you completely suspend the explanation that Dr. Liu gave you about the shot to the leg, if Douglas Benefield was running away, that's how you could get the shot in the leg. You might remember that the trajectory or the wound path to the leg was up. Ashley would have had to have been lying on the floor to shoot up so that the bullet would go in her calf. Dr. Liu explained to you exactly how that happened. We've had our summer law clerk, William Galvano, come here and demonstrate.
More continuing coverage is on the way.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Press subscribe now.